What's going on, everybody? Greg Mahochko here as we get set for episode 30 of Nerds United. Did I think a year and a half ago that I would ever actually make it to 30 episodes? No, I did not. Now, this is 30 official episodes that are each numbered accordingly, but you got to remember, we've had a few in there earlier in the year. Of course, we broke up the trip to the Cape Comic Con into two separate parts. We had episode 15's part 1 and 2, and right around that time also we had the crossover between myself, Nerds United, and The Good, The Bad, The Podcast. So we're actually, this will be technically, not officially, but technically episode 32. But for the purpose of continuity, the purpose of not confusing myself or any of you, this is episode 30. That's what it will be labeled as on the website, and don't forget, of course, on Stitcher, as well as iTunes, and from there, I guess, wherever you find your high-quality podcasts, and then this one. This one among all the other high-quality podcasts that you listen to. Before we get going into the show this time around, I just wanted to remind you that this upcoming Sunday, is the world premiere, if you will, of Four Color Eulogy. Had Jason and John and Taylor on the show, so long ago, but it really hasn't been. It was about four episodes ago or so. I'll tell you how long it was. The Cardinals were still in the playoffs. They were still playing baseball. That's how long it has been since we talked Four Color Eulogy. Their world premiere is coming up this weekend. Again, Sunday, November 23rd, the Tivoli Theater in the Del Mar Loop of St. Louis, if you're familiar with St. Louis. If not, Google that, because it's a fantastic theater. I won't be able to be there. I'll be in Chicago, or at least driving home from Chicago on Sunday. But I anticipate sometime very soon getting together and watching Four Color Eulogy. Maybe I'll be able to watch it with the cast and the crew. That'd be awesome. Maybe I'll catch it in a theater with more of you. That'd be cool, too. Or maybe I'll get a special private screening DVD Blu-ray sent to my home. I'm not holding my breath for that last one. Maybe someday we will have risen to the echelon that would, you know, get preview episodes, preview movies, things like that sent to the old homestead, but that's not happened just yet. But check it out, part of the St. Louis International Film Festival. 3 o'clock is when the curtain rises, if you will, for Four Color Eulogy, their world premiere. And that's, again, 3 o'clock on this upcoming Sunday, November 23rd, the Tivoli Theater, the Del Mar Loop, St. Louis International Film Festival. You could be among the first to see Four Color Eulogy. And if you happen to run into Jason or John or Nicholas or Taylor or Wyatt Weed, the director, any of them, tell them, I heard about this on Nerds United. And then maybe they'll come back and talk with me some more. That'd be cool, of course. So anyway, that of course is coming up, like I said, this weekend. In the meantime, we're not too far from Thanksgiving, a week from tomorrow, because I'm publishing this on Wednesday. So we'll take next week off. We'll pick it up here again in a couple of weeks. Might actually try to get together with some folks here in my neighborhood. Not neighborhood, but, you know, people that I have met personally. Maybe a past guest. Try to get together with them and just enjoy each other's company. Conversation about comic books, movies, TV, and more. So are you ready? Let's do it. The guest with me this time around, Dr. Michael Bitz, and he is the founder of the Comic Book Project. What's the Comic Book Project? We're going to talk about it. I'm going to learn more about it after the jump.
Comic books, movies, TV, and more. Nerds are everywhere. It's time to assemble! Nerds United, a Jittery Monkey podcast. Here's your host, Greg Mahochko.
Welcome into the Nerd Dome, Nerds United, episode 30. Greg Mahochko here, and I know for me personally, it was being a kid and getting excited about comic books. I had some hand-me-downs that were my uncle's, mostly Marvel titles. Came across a few more on spinner racks and grocery stores, you know, in my early teenage years. And then I kind of just fell away from comic books for a while and found them again, picked them up in my late adulthood, but, you know, the recent past year. If you've been listening to the show for a while, you know that story. I think it is imperative that kids have a knowledge and an understanding of comic books, and I'm so glad that I can bring in this week's guest, Dr. Michael Bitz, who founded the Comic Book Project and is all about comic books being created by kids in their school. Before we get to going about that, Michael, welcome to the show, and how are you doing, sir?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me. I'm really looking forward to the conversation.
I'm really looking forward to it as well. Like I said, comics were an integral part of my childhood. Reading those, you know, I dug them out here recently, and just a wave of memories of laying on the living room floor on a Saturday morning and ignoring the cartoons because I had an old comic book that dealt with the Avengers and the Fantastic Four in my hand, and I was just I couldn't tell you how many times I read them over and over and over and over. When did you become interested or excited about comic books? Did it happen for you in childhood as well?
You know, I did have a number of comics lying about like you did, and I did love to read them as a young child. And kind of like you, I went away from comics as I became what we would call a more traditional reader. You know, I loved to read books. I got into Stephen King. I got into classic literature. And I didn't discover comics again until I was a teacher, when my young students in New York City, fourth graders, were doodling Pokemon at the time, and they were really excited about these characters, and at the same time, they were really struggling with a lot of the English skills that I was trying to instill upon them. And I realized that if the kids could write words and dialogue and captions for these characters that they were doodling, they could get a grade for writing and become better writers and become dedicated writers, which is what happened. And that's really how the Comic Book Project was born. So I've been discovering comics anew. I've been getting into a lot of the comics that kids are turning me on to. There's lots of beautiful things out there, both for the educational market as well as just incredible comics in general. And it's a really exciting time for comics, I believe.
Michael, let's talk about your childhood. Tell me some of those memories that you have with the comic books, either how you acquired them or just how you spent your time reading them, maybe some of the titles and some of the characters you were reading about.
Yeah, I'm not really sure how I acquired them. I assume maybe my parents or maybe my sister or, you know, related family sort of dropped them onto my desk or onto my bed. I remember reading Archie comics. I remember reading Richie Rich and Casper the Friendly Ghost. I had some superhero comics, but not that many. They were more, comical comics. That was maybe what I was interested in. And I remember being excited by them because of the incredible colors, lots of the funny storylines. I liked humor as a kid, so I read a lot of funny books. And so those kinds of comics really sort of fit into my mode of where I was at the time.
Were you, now this is probably a little too technical or particular, but were you like a morning reader, afternoon reader? I always seemed to find that I would be reading, be it comic books or, you know, traditional books at bedtime. You know, when dad would say, hey, you know, yell into the bed, or yell down the hall, shut out the light, I was reading something. Do you remember, I mean, did it matter to you, or were you just happy to have something in your hands that you could read?
You know, I remember reading all the time. I loved reading as a kid, whether it was comics or novels. I loved horror. So I read, you know, whatever I could get my hands on. And, you know, this being pre-internet age, the public library, they never discriminated against you going from the adult section to the children's section. So I was reading very adult books at a young age, and I just remember loving reading. Now, I know that's not the same experience for many other kids out there, especially today with digital media and video games being at everybody's fingertips, reading is something more of a difficult thing to instill in kids. And that's why I really believe that comics hold an important place in the literacy space, because reading, you know, is the operative word. If you're reading, you're reading. And so, you know, I remember as a little kid being really excited by reading, and I've been trying to help others get into that brain space.
Now, I know just a moment ago you said, you know, the colors and some of the images, but it seems to me just in you know, talking with you for just a few minutes here, that the story was what drove you, to the comics more so than the pictures or the art. Would that be an accurate assumption?
I think that is accurate. I really didn't have a very strong visual arts background or training. For me, actually, I was really into music growing up, and still am. And so visual arts, you know, maybe not have been the way that my mind was working necessarily. So it was the story that really grabbed me. And typically, and I still do this today, I typically read the words in a comic and then look at the pictures. I don't think there's any right way to read a comic. And there's been some research about how people do read comics. Many people will look at the pictures first, try to get a sense of the story, and then read the captions or dialogue. But I've always been the other way, where I am reading the words first and then checking out the pictures next.
You said not sure if there's a right way to read comics. I'm not sure there's a wrong way to read comic books. But you mentioned, you know, kids of today have so much, you know, stimulus, be it the iPad or the iPhone or the video games. It started for me too, and I remember, you know, being a kid in the 80s, I got that regular NES, Nintendo Entertainment System, and a couple years after that, my friends got the Super Nintendo, and it seemed like reading fell out of fashion. At the same time, much to my parents' chagrin, being outside playing ball, riding bikes, also went by the wayside, because technology, and I can move, you know, be it characters or something like that, instead of flipping a page, I can move them with my thumbs. Video games, as fun as they have been, you know, for me, I look back and say, man, I could have spent, you know, so much more of my time doing something else.
I think that's true, but I also think that I don't think we'll ever, and this happened with television in the 1980s, you know, everyone looked at television as the devil, you know, it's taking away reading. I think especially now with technology moving ever more quickly, as adults, we need to be a little bit more open-minded and use these tools that kids are into as a pathway to reading. So for example, one thing that I learned, you know, kids who love video games, let's say they love playing, love playing Minecraft. There are plenty of books out there on the strategies of Minecraft, or there's plenty of fan fiction built on video games. So I think if a kid is really excited and hooked on a video game, there's actually a lot of opportunities for a teacher or a parent or whomever to then say, all right, you love this. Well, let's read this that's based on your interest. And actually, I think that could be a really great hook into reading.
And also, as we mentioned, you know, the technology that we have, you can get books, be it comic books or traditional books, some of the classics, right there on your iPhone or, you know, other tablet or mobile device. They you don't have to fill up bookshelves in the traditional sense that you know, I'm familiar with. I recently just got an e-reader, and it's a lot easier than carrying around a couple of books or you know, going about it that way. It takes up a lot less space, certainly in the home. It's another avenue, another outlet for not just kids, but I think everybody to take up reading once again.
I think that's true. You know, I think it's sad that the printed book will probably go away, maybe even in our lifetime, because it's been such a mainstay of our culture. But, you know, it just makes sense that reading on a digital platform is going to be the new way. What's interesting from an educational perspective is that many schools are not there yet. So, for example, in New York City, cell phones are not allowed inside the schools. And there's been this whole business built up where these converted ice cream trucks park outside a school building. Kids drop off their cell phone for a dollar and pick it up at the end of the day. And these little trucks are making millions of dollars over the course of the year because the schools have not figured out how to use these really powerful computers that every kid brings into the classroom or into, you know, brings around with them wherever they go, but they're not allowed in the classroom. They're not allowed in the school. So I think we're in a transition period, maybe we always will be, of where these kind of digital platforms fit into the mode of reading and learning in general.
Gutenberg is rolling over in his grave. And of course, I'm not talking, and I'm not talking about Steve Gutenberg. let's talk about, obviously you're an educator. Let's talk about that. And what made you decide to go into education, into teaching?
You know, it's a kind of a roundabout story. I was really, as I said before, a musician, and I was a professional musician. I played the bass in New York City. And as with many musicians, music education is something of a backup where you're saying, well, you know, I don't have enough gigs to cover my rent or buy food. So maybe I should think about this teaching gig, you know, where I could have a steady job and maybe play music at night. And so I went to graduate school for music education, and right away the education piece really struck me hard. I really started thinking a lot about how schools are structured and how kids learn and how we teach and how so much of that is based on a system that nobody really knows who the architect is, and there's no real good rationale for a lot of things that happen in a classroom. And so I started to the music piece of music of the music education kind of went to the background, and I started just thinking about arts and arts education, the role of the arts specifically. I got involved in a research project called Learning in and Through the Arts, where we were looking at the way that the arts can impact academic learning, like in math and reading. And we learned right away that it has to be a very close tying in of the art content and the academic content for there to be any real transfer of learning. And so as an educator, you know, and a teacher in the classroom, I was looking for the kinds of tools where the art and the academic content are closely tied. And that's where comics really came in, because you can't have a comic without the art, and you really can't have a comic without the writing. And so it became sort of the ideal vehicle for getting kids involved in creativity and the arts, as well as in writing and literature. And in many ways, that was the seeds of the comic book project born there.
Are you still an everyday classroom teacher, or have you moved on to other pursuits?
I have moved on to other pursuits. I am a faculty member at Ramapo College in New Jersey. It's a liberal arts college where I teach instructional technology as well as literacy. And I am still very much involved in the comic book project, where I lead workshops and I bring the program around to different schools all over the country and all over the world. And one of the things about it is I still do the workshops because I love them, you know, and somebody was saying the other day at a workshop in New York City, you know, you've been doing this for 13 years now. Don't you want to sort of give somebody else the torch to do the workshops? And no, for me, that's what it's about. It's about connecting with teachers, having a discussion about using creativity and using comics in the classroom. So I find that still very powerful.
Now, 13 years. So let's go back to 2001. What was the catalyst? That was it just your observations and your interactions in the classroom, or what got you thinking about what would become the comic book project?
Actually, what got me thinking about it was that research study that I had been involved in, and my teaching experience. But I was also working for a publishing company, which I'll go unnamed because I didn't have a great experience there. And we were creating textbooks and workbooks, very traditional things that you'd see pretty much in most classrooms. And I was just thinking to myself, you know, what would be the opposite of this? What would be the binary opposite of what we're doing right here, which I know is really not necessarily educationally sound? And so the idea of the Comic Book Project kind of came out of that, where it's not like a publishing company is going to produce a textbook for a kid. Here, the kid is going to produce the comic for other kids. And so the Comic Book Project really is about kids creating comics and sharing those comics with each other. And so I decided to quit my job, and I started the Comic Book Project in New York City with one after-school program in Queens. And it really grew from there, first in the after-school community in New York City, which is a very strong and rich network, and continues to be the heart and soul of the Comic Book Project in New York City today.
Tell me about that first meeting, that first interaction with the kids, that first time. Were they excited for it? Or did they really know? They probably didn't have any expectations coming in this after-school program. So tell me a little bit about that first interaction, that first explanation of what you were trying to accomplish.
You know, it's interesting to look back. They didn't have any expectations, and either did I. And I have to admit that I really didn't know what I was doing. But the kids were willing. And I think when you go into a classroom with this sort of open-minded experience of, okay, we're going to be making comics, but I'm going to be looking to you to help you, the students, the kids, to help define the process. They got very excited about, all right, we're going to form teams. We're going to sketch our characters. We're going to draft our storyline. We're going to work with each other, even if we're not creating the same story, to do some peer review and talk with each other about the strength of our characters and storylines. And then we're going to revise them and edit them. And then we're going to sketch them and pencil them out and add color and a cover. And then we're going to publish them. That initial process is really how the Comic Book Project found its groove and sort of continued on in that vein. That is still basically the process for the Comic Book Project today.
As a kid, me, when I was in school, the one who was kind of picked last in gym class and all that other stuff, I think the overall theme, generation to generation, kids just want to feel like they're a part of something, and they want to belong. They want that interaction, and pulling them from maybe different cliques or different groups of, you know, kids in school probably was a big thing. And I don't know, certainly, but you might have some insight. Maybe some new friendships were formed just out of, you know, comic books and being creative.
I think definitely. I think a lot of the kids who had never talked to each other in the class before were suddenly team members and working together. And I think just in general, you know, when a teacher is going through his or her educational training, you talk a lot about student-centered work and getting the students involved in decision-making. But in practicality, that rarely happens in many classrooms. And so I think we've sort of rediscovered that with the Comic Book Project, that, you know, when kids are creating anything, they have a voice, they're putting forth their ideas. When it's through comics, they are able to infuse their creativity, their narratives, their storylines. And it's kind of interesting. If you ask a middle school kid to say something about her life, what she's going through, you know, very often they're going to clam up and, you know, why would anybody really want to say, you know, exactly what they're going through? But through the context of a story, maybe even a fictional story that doesn't include them but some other character, they're able to infuse a lot of their emotions and feelings and experiences in a very authentic way. And I think that's part of the power of comics. That narrative piece is always going to be there. And when you're the creator, whatever that storyline is or whatever those characters are, there's some reflection of you in there. And I've enjoyed experiencing that over the years with the kids.
Everybody has a voice, and they want their voice to be heard. They just sometimes maybe don't know how to go about getting their words, getting their thoughts and their opinions out there.
I think that's right. And what we've seen, a couple of things. First off, kids who, you know, were throwing chairs against the wall were suddenly really engrossed in creating something. You know, this became a project that met many kids who were sort of abandoned by the wayside by the school system, just because traditional schooling is not the right fit for a lot of kids. And also thinking about kids who come to New York City or anywhere else new to the language, you know, just imagine coming, you know, if you moved to Germany and you didn't speak German, that's how lost you would feel. And I think the Comic Book Project has become a really great support system for those kids as well, because, you know, they can play with language, they can have fun with letters and words without having to write a full paragraph or speak a full sentence right at the outset. You can rely on the pictures and really become a part of whatever that literacy experience is. So I, you know, the famous John Dewey, who we study in graduate school in education, he was an educational philosopher. He said the 9/10 of all teaching should be visual. Well, how does that really happen in classrooms? I would say maybe 1/10 is visual. So we need to get back to the visual in our classrooms.
How different was this, you know, the outset or the beginnings, the humble beginnings, if you will, of the Comic Book Project as an after-school program? How much did that differ from other programs that were already in place? Because when I think of an after-school program, I just think of there's, you know, a couple of overseers, maybe that's not the best word, chaperones, who are just kind of looking out at the kids as they're heads down doing homework. How much different was this, and how much excitement did it generate from the kids after they started to become more involved in it?
Yeah, I think it was a unique experience for the after-school programs. You know, it's interesting. After-school programs have a unique dilemma in that the kids are supposed to be learning, but they don't have to be there necessarily. So they have to come up with some innovative ways to help the kids be learning, but have them want to come. And I think if most school teachers ask themselves, you know, would my kids really be here if they didn't have to be here? You know, I think we all know what the answer would be. And so one of the beautiful things about after school programming is that you can experiment a little bit. It's an opportunity for kids to explore and be creative. And so while it was obviously different from the homework help and such, I think it really spoke to a need in the what we call the out of school time world. And thousands of kids in New York City since have been involved after school in the Comic Book Project. And it's a real testament to the strength of the educators who are working after the school day, and as well as to the Comic Book Project for meeting those needs there.
I know that you have worked not just around the country, but around the globe, and we'll certainly talk about the Comic Book Project in Nigeria as we go along, but how long did it take for this idea to really grow legs and expand just beyond the after-school program?
Well, it grew quickly in New York City in the after-school program because there is such a good network of community organizations working in high-poverty neighborhoods, and they typically work together, share ideas. You know, somebody hears about this great program, and it gets passed on to this other network. So we grew quickly in New York City. Our partner nonprofit there called the After School Corporation helped us set up a pilot program where we work with about 40 after school programs in our, you know, second year. So that was a big jump. And it went quite well, and we continue to work with those programs today. Then what happened with the project is I knew I needed some support. You know, it was just me and this idea and these materials I created. And so I went back to my graduate school advisors at Teachers College at Columbia University and told them about what I was working on. And they were gracious enough to let the project, what we call it, be incubated by the college. So I was able to write grants for the project through Teachers College. I got a little office space and a little storage locker. And I started writing grants, and two grants landed in the first year. I think I wrote about maybe 20, and two of them landed. Not a great percentage, but at least something came through. One of them was funded by the Environmental Protection Agency, of all things. So in New York City, we ran a huge program for thousands of kids on the theme of the environment, and they created comics about the environment, and we produced a publication called Save Our City, Save Our Planet. That same year, the other place where the comic book project got funded was in Cleveland, Ohio, through the support of the Cleveland Foundation. And this was the first time that school teachers got involved in the project. What it was English teachers were helping kids write the comics in English class, and art teachers were helping kids create the comics in art class. So it became this really great interdisciplinary project where the kids were, you know, taking their comics from class to class, working on them, creating them. The theme that year was conflict resolution because of a lot of violence in the Cleveland schools. They produced a publication called Peace in Our Schools, and we had a very strong project in Cleveland for several years. So those were the sort of the first two places, you know, New York City and Cleveland. And from there, the project, you know, I continued writing grants. We continued building capacity for the project, and it started to spread. I can't even remember all the places we've been with the project, but just by way of example, we had an amazing project with Native Americans in Seattle. We had an amazing project with refugee children in Tucson, with migrant children in San Diego. So, you know, the project has really spread far and wide. And as you said, we've had some international programs as well.
Now, I sense that there are a lot of themes here, not just social issues, but, you know, global environmental issues, things like that. Are when kids sit down to, you know, start being creative, do they have any restrictions on them, or is it based on perhaps the location? As you mentioned, just for an example, the Cleveland group, you know, they were working on the essentially bullying or you know, conflict resolution. Is it tied? Is one hand kind of control? Now, I don't want to say controlling, but are there ties between what Grant is making this possible and the content of the works being created?
That's a good question. Well, first off, I just want to say that there's only one rule in the comic book project when the kids are creating their comics, and that rule is you must create original characters and original storylines. You cannot use characters who have been created by anybody else in the past. And so originality is the one rule of the project. But we learned early on with the project that if kids are basing their comics on a theme like leadership or community or the environment or whatever the theme might be, it helps them really focus their comics in a way that establishes usually a stronger storyline and a stronger set of characters. Yes, of course, there are plenty of kids who have made comics just, you know, making a comic either because they love comics or they share, you know, an interest with other kids or their families and they got into comics. But by and large, most of the kids whom we work with are not really comics fans and didn't grow up with comics. So having a theme helps the kids focus on a idea or a concept. And of course, the themes are important social themes. So, you know, so to speak, kill two birds with a stone in that they're being creative and making great comics, but they're also thinking critically about an important issue in their lives, whether it's something happening to them personally or something around the world. And so while I understand the sort of concept that having a theme might be somewhat limiting to the kids, we have often found that it's somewhat liberating in the sense that it helps kids get quickly on a path to creation. They can brainstorm about what the scenario is and who the heroes and villains might be in the story, and then, of course, reflect upon that important theme.
I knew that, even as I was asking the question, I knew that the word control wasn't right, but guide definitely, you know, put me back on the right path, as you know, giving them just a little nudge in the right direction, and like you said, they can focus their creative energies. Now, being that this is a you know, the first group, that first after school program group, you know, those kids were middle school, sixth grade, seventh grade, something like that.
Yes.
And 13 years later, I know that with the number of individuals that you've worked with over 13 years, you probably can't keep in touch with them all, but have you heard or anybody reaching out to the comic book project or Edpath just about, thank you for opening up my eyes to comic books. Now I have a love of them. I'm trying to either, you know, get work independently or anything, like trying to turn it into any type of career. Have you seen any of those type of stories?
We have. We've seen it over and over again. Kids, you know, it's interesting. There are some kids who have gone on to, well, there's plenty of who have gone on to continue making comics, but probably not on a professional level. But a number of kids have gone into marketing, digital media, children's book publishing. So we really do feel that the skills that have been imparted in the comic book project, that is creative original thinking, working towards a deadline, editing and revising, working collaboratively, all those skills have helped a number of our young people go on to careers in whatever it is that they want to do. Specifically, though, I worked very closely with one after-school program, a high school program in New York City, and it was the subject of my first book called Manga High. And these kids were absolutely knee-deep in manga. That was what their life was about. In fact, you know, they gave each other – these were city kids in New York City, no Japanese kids in their schools, had never been to Japan, but they had given each other Japanese names. They were teaching each other how to speak Japanese. And these kids I have stayed in touch with because, you know, they were the subject of my first book, and I was able to really work closely with them. And those kids, many of them have gone on to do some really great things. One of the kids, his name was Keith Hunter. He was homeless while I was writing the book. And so the after-school manga club was his life source. I mean, that was the only thing keeping him connected to the school and life in general. He was in foster care, and he aged out of the system and suddenly wound up on the street. That young man now is one of the city's most vocal spokespeople for foster care and foster care reform. And so the comic book project was really his lifeline. And we, you know, we kept him afloat while he was going through these really difficult times. And the comics that he was creating at the time are really indicative of his life stories. And so there have been a lot of amazing stories from the kids who have been through the project and how it's inspired them to do great things in life.
Manga High, which you mentioned, one of two books that you have put out. Tell me a little bit now. Manga High, is it based on the cover? What I'm seeing here on the comic book project, or excuse me, comicbookproject.org. Is it a collection of the students' works with a little bit of narration or a foreword by you? Tell me a little bit about the composition of the book.
The book is broken into two parts. The first part is an exploration of my experience with the kids and their teacher at this club. I was aware of manga at the time, but I really wasn't aware of how dedicated some young people were to it. These were kids who were creating and reading manga whenever they got a chance, after school, before school, and sometimes during school. And what I was trying to highlight in the book in the first part was these kids are reading and writing on their own time at a voracious pace, incredible volumes of sketchbooks and notepads of words, art, sentences, paragraphs, and yet many of these kids were failing school. And so what I wanted to try to identify in the book was what is the thing that we're missing that these kids are reading and writing so feverishly, and yet their school teachers are not recognizing this interest and ability in them. So that's the first part of the book. And then the second part of the book, I selected student work and presented it because really that's what it's all about. It's the comics that the kids create. And I presented that work with each of the kids' sort of backstory, as well as some analysis of the kind of comic that they were creating. So it's a balance between looking at the club itself and then highlighting the students who are involved in the program.
Your other book appears to be more of a how-to, maybe for teachers, educators, administrators, When Commas Meet meet Kryptonite, Classroom Lessons from the Comic Book Project. Is that kind of a guide, like I said, a how-to perhaps of getting, you know, kids interested in, be it in art, in literature, in learning based on what you saw, based on your experience with the comic book project?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. It's a, you know, if I look at Manga High as like a microscope on one comic book club, I look at my other book, When Commas Meet Kryptonite, as sort of a telescope on the whole comics and education world through the lens of the comic book project. And explored comics both from their opportunities, or the opportunities that they afford for reading development and writing development, trying to analyze comics from an educational perspective and sort of really speaking to, like you said, teachers, principals, librarians, administrators, about how comics could really come into a school and into a classroom in a dynamic way. And so they really are some of the lessons that I've learned based on the comic book project, as well as tips and activities for teachers to actually implement in their own classrooms.
There are some fantastic stories out there in the comic book medium that work not just on an art level, not just on a literature level, but just kind of overall. What did you use particularly or specifically any stories, any comic arcs, graphic novels in your education, just as a way to you know, convey a story, convey a style of writing to your classroom?
You know, from the very beginning, I was really focused on not bringing in professionally designed comics, but having a real spotlight on the comics that the kids themselves create and then sharing those with each other. So my focus has always been on the literature developed by the kids themselves. However, I think there are some amazing comics out there that are absolutely ideal and appropriate for the classroom. I think it can be something of a challenge, especially for a teacher who wants to, you know, dip his or her toe into the comics stream, but it doesn't have a background in comics. You will find, of course, that there are many comics that are not appropriate for the classroom. However, the American Library Association has a great list of age-appropriate comics, and companies like First Second Books, I think, are producing some really quality graphic novels and comics literature that aren't specifically designed for middle schoolers, but reach that vibe and that audience and that sort of ethos. And so, I, you know, those are the places that I would start with bringing comics into the classroom.
In all of your travels and all of the workshops that you've done, has there been any, you know, child created, kid created characters that just, you know, make you smile when you think of them, that really stand out to you?
Oh man, there's so many great, so many great comics.
That, loaded, you know, question.
Really, that's really what the incredible feeling of the comic book project has been, you know, not necessarily how it's expanded, but the stories that the kids have told and how great those stories are. There are a couple of really amazing ones, but I was thinking of one that was created in California a couple of years ago. The character was called Inertia Man, and it was created in a physics classroom. And so Inertia Man was battling Anti-Newton Man, and Inertia Man was using the three laws of Newtonian physics at really in depth to battle the villain who was trying to destroy the world. And it was such a creative approach, and just sort of stands out in my mind about how creativity can really boost learning. If you were just to give kids, you know, the three laws of physics and this is going to be on the test next week, you know, that's why kids are really not into that kind of stuff. But if you, you know, like this kid made a comic and published it and had it shown around the world, I guarantee you that that kid is never going to forget the laws of physics because of that great comic based on Inertia Man. So a comic like that is really, really creative, really good character design. And, you know, it's just one of the many, many incredible comics that kids have created over the years.
Inertia Man. I already feel like I'm out kicking my coverage, as they say. I'm in unfamiliar waters when it gets to physics and things like that. Speaking of waters, you crossed a mighty sized body of water and took the comic book project to Nigeria. How was it that Nigeria ended up on your radar in this capacity?
You know, it didn't. It wasn't on my radar. It became on the Nigerians' radar. There was a professor of communication who read an article that I had written for the Journal of Adolescent and Adult Literacy, you know, a scholarly journal. And he read the article about the comic book project and got excited about it. That was in 2006. And so for about 6-7 years, we just communicated back and forth about how we could get this thing going. He started the comic book project over there on his own, and I gave him some, you know, support, and we emailed back and forth about ideas. And eventually we were able to get a grant from the Ford Foundation and the UN to bring me over there for 10 days to work with teachers and librarians. And so and the Reading Association of Nigeria was a big part of that. And so I was able to deliver a number of workshops there. I brought 2 suitcases full of materials. I hardly brought any clothes because I just stuffed my bags full of materials and distributed as much as I could while I was there, and set the seeds for the project to continue on, which it has. I would love to go back to Nigeria and work with those teachers and librarians again, because it was quite an interesting experience. What I realized right from the very workshop is many of those teachers did not know what comic books were. I had a cultural assumption that this was a worldwide phenomenon and they would just know what I was talking about. But comics are not nearly as popular in Nigeria. And so I had to sort of introduce what a comic book was midway through the first workshop, as I realized that not many of the people knew what I was talking about. But once they got on board with this connection between visual literacy and traditional literacy, they got really excited about the project and were creating all kinds of great comics in their workshops. Interestingly enough, this was right when the terrorist group Boko Haram was starting to become a national news issue. And so a number of the comics that the teachers were creating in their workshops were reflecting on this, you know, terrible thing that was happening in their country. And I think it just speaks to the power of giving people a creative voice. And it would be unlikely that most people in the U.S. would create a comic about Boko Haram, but because it was so important to people in Nigeria, that's what their comics were focused on at the time. And it was an incredible for me, and one that I really do hope to recreate down the line.
I was just going to ask what kind of stories were shared, were created, were told. I didn't know, obviously, you know, the Boko Haram, but I didn't know if maybe they would be finding a way to put some of their traditional, you know, national legend stories, you know, things that are handed down through generations. I didn't know if they would have been able to put those down on paper in a way that did those probably amazing stories some amount of justice.
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure that I saw traditional Igbo or Hausa cultural traditions. What I did see, however, where I was in the south of the country, which is a very religious Christian area. And so a number of the comics were reflecting on their Christian values. And so, you know, I remember a teacher creating a comic about his neighbor who was kind of drunk and lazy and hadn't found, you know, religion. And the comic was about how this neighbor was going down, 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 while, you know, the other neighbor on the other side, you know, was church going and was going up, up, up. That's just a cultural phenomenon that was represented in the comic. And, you know, I just think it's another example of how education should be personalized. It should be what's important to you and give you the opportunity to share that with other people through those creative outlets.
Everyone's experiences are different, and because of that, everyone's the way that they decipher information is all different. So it's such a challenge. I could never be a teacher, I don't think. I don't know how anybody can, because you have to, you know, try to convey a certain amount of information to so many who will learn it in completely different ways.
I think that's true, but then, you know, that's also the fun of being a teacher, when you can then become, you know, what I would call an instructional designer, where you can create projects where kids can explore their own experiences within a content area or within a subject. You know, if you take something like history and, you know, let's say we're talking about the Civil War, there could be any number of projects that kids could do to reinforce the content. They could be making comics. They could be writing songs. They could be writing a play. I think it's, you know, once the content is put out there, then the next step is to help kids internalize it through activities and through creative ideas. From my perspective, that's really what it's all about.
So you've been to Nigeria. Has the comic book project taken you anywhere else in the world?
You know, what's interesting in this digital age is the comic book project has gone to other places in the world, but I haven't. I would love to go, but I haven't really had the opportunity. So right now, the comic book project is happening in China. It's happening in Jordan, Australia, Mexico, Canada, Dominican Republic. And it's been quite extraordinary to just sort of take this model, which is a really simple model by design. The model is, you know, think about who your characters are, create a plot, sketch it out panel by panel, storyboard style, and then design your comic. I think the simplicity has really spoken to learners all around the world and teachers all around the world. And I'd certainly love to visit these places and see the program in action. But I think that's one place where technology has served me not well, because it's easy enough to just email and Skype like we're doing right now, mm-hmm. rather than visiting in person, which I would love to do.
You better get your passport primed up and ready to go.
Exactly.
But as we're getting close to the end here, wanted to ask you, I have a friend who, when he was in college just a couple of years ago, finishing up some of his studies, for whatever reason, he's more of an, you know, watch sports, you know, kind of a sports guy. So I don't know why he took a course on comic books, comic book characters, but I know that the big project at the end was to take one of the more established, you know, characters, more mainstream, I guess, characters, and essentially do like a PowerPoint presentation or something like that. So he said, "Hey, Greg, can I come over? Will you help?" And I said, "Okay, what's the deal?" He said, "Well, you know everything about Green Lantern. So you want to help me with this project?" I said, "Yeah." You know, he brought his wife over, and you know, we had a meal, and I told him about as much as I could about the Green Lantern. I said, "Now, wait a minute. Do you want to know about Hal Jordan, Green Lantern, the first one from Earth, or the Green Lantern Corps?" And he looked at me. He said, "There's more than one." Because comic books, the comic book characters are so mainstream. I mean, if you look at, you know, Guardians of the Galaxy, which was not a well-known title in comic books until really this year, and then it's the top grossing movie at the box office so far in 2014. Because comics have gone so mainstream, what are your thoughts on them invading, I guess, academia as much as they have?
It's an interesting question, because when I started the Comic Book Project in 2001, comics were really not a part of education in any meaningful way. Now, you know, 10 or more years later, if you look at the Scholastic publishing catalog, the company Scholastic, which is probably the largest producer of children's books, about half of it is graphic novels now. And it has really become a go-to for many teachers as they're trying to engage their kids in literature and learning. And personally, I think it's great. I think the more that we can get kids excited about reading and the more diverse kinds of literature we can present to them. And I think it's amazing when comics are presented as literature so that kids could realize, oh yeah, there's this Shakespeare play. And then there's also, you know, this incredible comic, you know, from a historical perspective, this Green Lantern comic that I'm also reading in school. I think that's really where kids get excited about school and, you know, really start to think about the world in different ways. So I know a lot of people have, you know, with the mega media and the movies and the marketing, there are some concerns about comics sort of, you know, jumping the shark, so to speak. But from my perspective as an educator, I think the more diversity that we have in literature and comics being a real part of that, I think it's to our advantage.
Michael Bitz of the Comic Book Project. Now, this is where I'm going to ask you to put your salesman hat on. If there are any, you know, faculty members, superintendent, board members, teachers, anything like that who might be listening to this podcast, Michael, sell them. Sell them on this. Tell them what they need to do to get something like the Comic Book Project started at their school.
Sure, absolutely. Well, our website is comicbookproject.org. And if you click on the participate page, you can see how to sign up for the classroom kits as well as individual kits. You know, speaking of selling, you know, holiday time is coming up. An individual kit would be a perfect gift for a young person who you're thinking, what am I going to get this kid at this point? You know, especially a middle schooler or a high schooler. So think about that. And I would also encourage people to, you know, now not selling. If you look through resources at the, for example, the International Reading Association has a website called Read Write. I think it's called Read Write Think. And there's a lot of lesson plans out there for comics. There are even templates you can use. So just be creative and explore what's out there. We think that the Comic Book Project experience is a really great one, but there are some other, and of course you could create your own very own comic book project through some simple modeling and things like that. So you know, I think the bottom line, what I'd really like to sell is creativity in the classroom. You know, if we could get every teacher to help kids be creative and to for the teachers themselves to think creatively about lessons and assignments, then we've really done something.
Be it materials or what? What does the Comic Book Project need? In the and if you answer that question, I've got a follow-up statement where some folks can go and get some comics and help out the Comic Book Project. So what does the Comic Book Project need to stay the course?
You know, actually, it's interesting. We've had many comics donations over the years of people's collections, and that's actually quite difficult for us to manage. So really the way that people can support the project is by, you know, purchasing our materials, attending our workshops, and then also spreading the word about the project. You know, if you love the idea and you think that a library or a school in your community would be interested, spread the word, get them excited about it. You know, we can always send them sample materials or a link, and that's really how we'd love to keep growing.
Now, it's no secret, Michael and I, we haven't been best friends for years, you know, like some of my other, you know, previous guests. We just started talking, you know, essentially to set up this interview, but I came to know about the Comic Book Project from one of the individuals at one of my previous guests, Anthony Mathenia of Stash Publishing. And what I want to share with you, the listener, is that you can go online and you can purchase Stash Publishing's new anthology. It's called Out of the Blue. And the proceeds are going to the Comic Book Project. And I know, Michael, you've talked with Anthony as well, and probably have even you know, come across or read some samples, if not from Out of the Blue, but of other works that Stash Publishing has put out. And being a guy who has worked in nonprofit organizations, we'll take any little bit that helps, correct?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's a great way. That's very generous of them to support us in that way, to donate proceeds from the sales of their book. So we're really grateful for that. And, you know, I think it's a great partnership.
And you can get the link on the Nerds United Facebook page. Of course, I'll link it on the website with this post as well, so that you can check out of the Blue and help out Comic Book Project as well. comicbookproject.org. Is there any other? I saw that you do have a Facebook page, Michael, but is it not used a whole lot? Are you focusing more on the website or?
Yeah, I think we need to build our social media presence a little bit better, but our website is really sort of the entree into the Comic Book Project. And you know, we love for people to join us on Facebook as well. But you know, if you have any questions or interest in the Comic Book Project, a simple email through the website is probably the best way.
Dr. Michael Bitz, I want to thank you very much for joining me, lesser for joining me on Nerds United, more so for keeping kids interested in comics, specifically on the creative side, and looking forward to more good things from the Comic Book Project down the road.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that is, again, Dr. Michael Bitz. Check out the website, comicbookproject.org. You can just search on Facebook for The Comic Book Project and, again, get that link from the website for Stash Publishing's new anthology, Out of the Blue, where you purchase Out of the Blue, a collection of strange stories, and you can help out The Comic Book Project. That is it, episode number 30 for Nerds United. I'm Greg Mahochko. My guest again was Dr. Michael Bitz, and we'll see you next time on Nerds United.
This is a production of the Jittery Monkey Podcast Network. For more jittery shenanigans, go to jitterymonkey.com.